The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne Scott James, what is cryogeny? C-R-Y-O-G-E-N-Y. Cryogeny.
Cryogeny sounds rather melancholy thing. Something you don't want.
Well, it depends where you are.
Weepable.
You might want it very, very badly in the middle of the summer.
Oh, if it was somewhere hot.
Yeah.
It's something to do with the cold.
Yes. That's better.
It's extreme cold. Icing.
Icing will do. 2 marks. It is, in fact, refrigeration, a rather grand Greek word for refrigeration. And cryogen is a freezing mixture, which before you had present kind of refrigerators, you had to put in and get things cold. 2 marks. Frank Miller, what is a cavy? C-A-V-Y.
It's a short, sharp shout. from a schoolboy when the master hoves inside.
That's why I put the Y on the end.
Well, how do you spell the other cave?
C-A-V-E.
No, E-acute.
Yes, you get that if you like.
Sir, it's also an animal.
Yes?
Oh. Cavey, it's a startled rabbit. A startled hare is a cavey.
It's a wallaby.
No, one out of two. That'd be a marsupial. That's quite different. It's a small American rodent, similar to a guinea pig or a capybara, and lives normally in South America. Now, Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a chignon? C-H-I-G-N-O-N. Chignon.
I'm looking for one in the audience. It's a thing that you have on the back of your head, which is composed of hair.
Mm-hmm. I think that's quite good enough.
Scalp.
Hair.
Definition I've got is a mass of hair at the back of the neck, usually worn on a pad. I think that was quite a long time ago. It can just be a bun that you wear at the same point at the back of the neck. And in fact, back of the neck is what matters, because it's a French word meaning nape of the neck. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is iritis? I-R-I-T-I-S.
Iritis. It sounds like an illness of some kind.
Yes.
In your right eye, I think.
Yes,
an illness of the right eye.
Illness of the iris of the eye, I suppose,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh, that's a good idea. Yes, of the iris of the eye.
Mm-hmm. You got that.
Yeah. Oh, is that it?
Yeah. Iritis is inflammation of the iris of the eye. Well done.
I must say, the lady in the audience muttered she got it in her knee.
You were just an eye on it. Yeah.
That's off rather than ah, I think. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation form to write down, and the 2 women members of the team will, I hope, go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where those quotations come from. Now, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "The proof of the pudding is in the eating." And Dennis Powell and Frank, your quotation, "I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. The next round's about origins and derivations of words and expressions and phrases, and I give 3 marks if members of the teams can first of all say what the present meaning is and then what it comes from as a phrase. Anne Scott James begins, "To play to the gallery."
Well, to play to the gallery means to show off.
Yes.
With the worst section of your audience in mind.
Yes.
Well, it's obviously a histrionic origin, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Did you meant you shouted and ranted very much so that your voice would carry to the gallery?
I think that's almost near enough, yes.
Can you improve on this?
Yeah.
I think that's about right. 3 marks. Frank Muir, panties.
You're suggesting that nobody knows their present meaning. It's a form of garment that stands between a lady and her outer garments. Yeah. It's an abbreviated trouser.
Yeah. Origin?
I've always thought they were from the Victorian pantaloon.
Yeah.
Which was a sort of long undergarment worn by little children in Kate Greenaway drawings, amongst others. And
Frank, who was pantaloon?
He was an old fool.
Yeah. And what do you wear?
A similar garment to the one we've been talking about, as chance would have it.
Yeah, that'd be all right. 2.5. Panties or pants come from this foolish old character in the rather mannerized 16th century Italian comedy called Pantaloon, who was always dressed in long, baggy trousers, and he was the butt to everybody, including the clown. But curious enough, he came from the patron saint of Venice, St. Pantaleon, who was a very distinguished character indeed. Pantaloon, panties. Dennis Powell, what is a turnspit and why?
A turnspit?
Hmm.
I thought it was a spit that turned.
No.
You roast things on
doesn't
there.
Doesn't necessarily turn itself.
Doesn't necessarily turn. You have to push it.
Who pushes?
The dog pushes it.
What's it do?
The dog walked a sort of squirrel cage, imagine, yes, they gave it a kick.
Mm. If, as you frequently do, Jellis, you use the expression poor turnspit, what do you mean?
I've never used it. Dream of it.
I am awfully trying to help.
It means poor doggy.
Poor dog, yes.
But why is he poor?
I beg your pardon?
Why is he poor?
He hasn't got any money.
Because he just has to do this disagreeable job with blinkers on or inside a cage.
And it's hot. One it's side hot. Of him is hot.
Yes. he doesn't get the food at the end of it.
That's the point.
He doesn't get the food.
All right. He one and a half, because I help quite a bit. Nowadays, we use it at all, which not many of us do. It's a person who does all the work but gets none of the rewards for his labours. And it was a long-bodied, short-legged dog who had to work on this treadmill or treadwheel, and he turned the joint by this method. So he really cooked the joint, but other people ate it.
He actually started out as a short-bodied, long-legged.
Dennis Norden, stuck up.
Well, it means what? Snobbish, pretentious, conceited.
Mm.
And it comes from, I suppose it comes from having your nose stuck. Mark Twain has a line about he walked as though he was balancing his family tree on his nose. I suppose it means people who are stuck up have their nose in the air.
I think that's just about as good a guess as what I've got written down here. I think I'd give you 3 marks for that. And there are, in fact, various explanations. One from Australia. Stick-ups on lonely roads were fairly common. Though whether they were stuck up in the other sense of the word, I just wouldn't know. The next round is about verse and poetry. What I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and then ask them to complete it with the next line or so. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 marks if they can give me the author and the source. Beginning with Anne Scott James. And will not say when my bell of quittance is heard in the gloom, and a crossing breeze cuts a pause in its outrollings, till they rise again as they were a new bell's boom.
Sing. I can't understand a word.
I think it's a translation from the Serbo-Croat.
Is it worth knowing?
Yes. They were worth knowing.
What is that? Oh, we don't know it.
No,
no.
I don't
know. We've got to
I can't help it.
Just learn from you, Jack.
It's Thomas Hardy. It's called Afterwards, and this bit goes, and will any say when my bell of quittance is heard in the gloom, and a crossing breeze cuts a pause in its outrollings, till they rise again as they were a new bell's boom, he hears it not now, but used to notice such things.
Terribly difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, now, Frank Muir. As fair thou art, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear.
Until these gang are dry, my love. Until the seas gang dry. Until the seas gang dry.
author?
Ballard. It's a Scottish gentleman.
Yes.
For Groat, it'll be Barnes.
Yes, Barnes.
It's My Love is Like a Red Red.
That's it. Lack. Well done, four marks. It's My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose by Robert Burns. And Frank has got it quite right. As fair thou art, my bonnie lass, so deep in love, and I will love thee still, my dear, till the seas gang dry. And it was written to a little girl called Jean Cruikshank. There's a connection of my wife, and it wasn't one of his girlfriends.
Oh.
It was daughter of a minister on the border. Phyllis Powell. Down along the rocky shore, some make their home. They live on crispy pancakes of yellow tide foam.
Edward Lear.
It ought to be, but it isn't.
It's not.
Is it...
Not Thackeray, the Rosemary,
no,
or something.
No, no. They're very afraid of little men.
Beg your pardon?
They're very afraid of little men. Any help?
Little Women. Louise M. Alcott.
I'll give you one last hope. It starts up the airy mountain. Any help?
Down the rushy glen.
Mm-hmm.
Goblin Market.
Christina Rossetti. That's one always gets wrong. I'm sorry, I can't give you any marks. I'm trying to help. It's The Fairies by a chap called William Allingham, who is, I think, mercifully otherwise, rather obscure. It goes down along the rocky shore. Some make their home. They live on crispy pancakes of yellow tide foam. Some in the reeds of the black mountain lake, with frogs for their watchdogs all night awake. It's terribly arch, I think. No marks. Dennis Norden. When shepherds pipe on oaten straws, and merry larks are ploughmen's clocks, when turtles tread and rooks and daws, and maidens bleach their summer smocks.
It's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's a Shakespeare song. Shakespearean song.
Yes.
It's something to do with the cuckoo.
Yes.
Which married men fear.
Yes.
What have you got to do now?
Now we've got to make home in on the play. I think we'll give
as you like
best.
It. Try as you like it.
Try as you like it. No.
I'm going to give you 2.5 marks. You've got quite a lot of it. It's the song right at the end of Love's Labour's Lost and starts when icicles hang by the wall. And this bit goes, when shepherds pipe on oaten straws and merry larks are ploughmen's clocks, when turtles tread and rooks and daws and maidens bleach their summer smocks, the cuckoo then on every tree mocks married men, for thus sings he, cuckoo, 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 a word of fear unpleasing to a married ear. 2.5, I think, would be fair. And now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Jack, I never know what you mean when you say that women members of the team study their quotations. I never have a spare second to you. I haven't studied it very well. I would have thought it was just a proverb.
I think that's quite good enough. It is a proverb. It occurs in a book of proverbs by a chap called William Camden in 1623, but I'm sure he pinched it from somebody else. And therefore, I think you can say, just say it's traditional. Now, to Miss Powell, I like the origin of your quotation. I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you.
It's a song.
Mm.
And it's something...
I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you. I've got one lover and I don't want two. Oh, I've gone so hushed.
Oh, no.
Music hall song written by a chap called Thomas Miller. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden and his quotation. The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Well, there's no doubt that the winters in England are getting progressively worse. And what is the government doing about it? Nothing. There's some vague plan for weather-stripping Scotland, but other than that, all we get are these commercials thrown at us on television urging us all to install central heating. Now, if you do happen to do that, please don't fall into the trap that I did. Do employ a qualified heating engineer
not the man from the bicycle shop. I don't know how I was fooled by him. Even the money was a problem, of course, but I should have suspected that his knowledge of plumbing was a little perfunctory when we went to buy the essentials, because having ordered the boiler, he then said to the man, "And I'd like some lengths of piping, please." And the man said, "Would you like them male and female?" And he said, "I want them for heating, not breeding." I can't tell you what a right mess he made of the whole job. He said, I knew nothing about it, really. And when he said to me, "Look, you don't want to go to the extra expense of hiding the pipes under the floorboard, do you?" I said, "No." He said, "So you don't mind if they're visible, do you?" And I said, "No." So he ran the pipes just straight across the room. The middle of the room. At waist level. In the drawing room, there are two return lengths of pipe. So it's like an assault course in there. And so when it came to this winter, I thought, well, you know, no messing about this time. I'll get an expert from the Solid Fuel Advisory Council, because the boiler that he'd put in did consume solid fuel, you know. And he saw what was wrong at a glance, you see. He said, "What you've got here is substantial heat loss." So I said, "Well, what do you mean, you see?" And he explained to me the principle of in central heating, which is really quite simple, you see. You have a boiler down in the bottom of the house, and you have this tank at the top of the house, and a kind of circuit of pipes between them. Well, my idiot had run the pipes up the outside of the house and over the roof. See, so the consequence was that the rooms were like ice, but the outside brickwork was glowing. We were sitting in there munching anti-frostbite tablets while up the drain pipe bougainvillea was blossoming. So I said, "Well, there must be some kind of remedy for this." And he said, "Yes, you lag the pipes." He said, "I suggest something like felt." Well, as soon as he left, I went out with a tape measure and measured, and it would mean I needed about 380 feet of felt, which you will agree is really what they mean when they say a long felt want. And it was obviously much too expensive to do it that. And I thought, well, what other material can I get that would maintain? And I suddenly had a marvellous idea. Blankets. You know, because blankets must maintain the heat, otherwise we'd be cold in bed. Well, there are some people cold in bed, but it's not because of blankets, see? So I thought, well, the cheap way to buy blankets is to get them through this army surplus sales that they have. So I looked up the next army surplus sale, got a catalogue, found out where the blankets were. And there is another chap who sometimes comes round and does odd jobs around the house, you know, to a bit of money. And I got hold of him and I said, "Look, Frank," I said, "this is what I want you to do." As you go down and you purchase this lot number 936, you see. Now, I'll tell you something about Frank. He is, as you know, very good at anything to do with words. But anything to do with figures, his memory is not so good. So instead of getting lot 936, he got lot 639. He arrived back with 250 pair of ex-Women's Army Service Corps khaki woolen bloomers. I admit the house now, with every outside pipe lagged with ex-Women's Army Service Corps woolen bloomers, has become somewhat of a local landmark. They run coach tours. But nevertheless, it does the job. So as we say in the plumbing trade, in matters of this kind, the proof of the padding is in the heating.
Well, I can't wait to be invited to
Dennis Norden's drawing room and see what happened. Now, back to Frank Miller, and his quotation was, if you remember, I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you.
A letter to the chief of the insurance company, which recently sent me an invitation to join their insurance scheme. Dear Miss Denchel, when your advertisement arrived, it irritated me. Due to your advertisement, damage has been done to my household, and although I haven't actually joined yet, I wish to claim for it. Now, the first thing the advertisement said, in a rather vulgar type face, was, are you properly covered against accidents in the home, such as falling tiles? I realised I wasn't. I was in bed bareheaded. There's no reason why the tile shouldn't fall inwards, just as well as outwards, when you come to think of it. This is more logical for it. So, I remembered that I had an old, rather small air raid warden's tin hat, which is at the back door, upside down on chains, with a geranium in it. And I know it's there, because every time I come in and out, I hit my forehead against the edge. So I nipped downstairs very quickly with an apprehensive eye upwards for falling tiles, tipped the geranium out of the little tin hat, and put it on my head. Then I consulted your leaflet further, and the second thing it says, when estimating what insurance you should go in for, take a long view. I didn't quite see the point of this. In fact, it was very difficult to get it, because the only view we had was Whitby showing the old groin, and that was 8 inches by 6 inches. Not at all. But I found by burrowing through drawers an old photograph of my son's prep school, and that was definitely a long view. It was a view of the school, and it was about 3 foot long by about 5 inches wide. So I had my long view, and I was protected against the falling tiles. The third point you made was to estimate how much it will cost. See table. Well, that's what you wanted, Miss Denchel. So I went down to the dining room and had a good look at it. Well, it's an oval table, mahogany, twin pedestal with a leaf in it, because my mother-in-law was coming. We only put the leaf in when my mother-in-law's coming or my wife and I have had a row and don't want to talk at breakfast. Keeps us just that further apart. And the leaf was in. I looked at it. There it was. I found it didn't help me, Miss Denchel, estimate how much insurance, but I obeyed. Then I looked at the last exhortation on your card, and it said, don't wait, get on to it now. Now, Miss Denchel, this was not an easy instruction to carry out. For one thing, the warden's tin hat was on the small side and wobbly, and I had to step very carefully on the chair, rather like a native woman with a bucket of washing on her head. I had to balance the tin hat on. I got onto the table, clutching the long view of my son's prep school. And that's when it happened. The table gave way, the leaf collapsed, split in two, the hat flew off, crushed against the wall and dented itself so that it could no longer hold a geranium, and the view, long though it was torn in half as I fell. So, Miss Denchel, due to your advertisement, damage has been done to my household, and although I haven't actually joined yet, I wish to claim for it. So would you please send me by return £80.06. The damage I estimate your advertisement did to my household property, to wit and viz, a wooden leaf, my little warden hat view.
Well, by your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and I'm very happy to see him still reasonably hale and hearty here tonight. But the contest as a whole is also won by his side, that is Frank Muir and Dennis Bauer, who win by 1.5 marks from Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.